Hello and welcome to another episode of Twimmel Talk, the podcast where I interview interesting people doing interesting things in machine learning and artificial intelligence. I'm your host, Sam Charrington. This week on the pod, we are excited to present our AI in sports series, perhaps especially apropos given that much of the globe is glued to the World Cup at the moment. While I'm not personally the biggest sports fan, my producer, Amari, is a huge sports follower, and this series has been something he's wanted to see for a while now. So if you like these shows, be sure to send him a shout out on Twitter at Twimmel underscore Amari, I-M-A-R-I. In this episode of the series, I'm joined by Jennifer Hobbs, senior data scientist at Stats, a collector and distributor of sports data, covering sports like basketball, soccer, American football, and rugby. Jennifer and I explore the Stats data pipeline and how they collect and store different types of data for easy consumption and application. We dig into the paper she co-authored, Myth-Busting Set Pieces in Soccer, which takes a look at the data surrounding free kicks and corner kicks in soccer in an effort to debunk some long-standing myths around various situations. If you're using machine learning to try to predict World Cup winners, you'll definitely want to check out this segment. Finally, Jennifer and I chat about potential projects and applications of machine learning to sports and the accessibility of sports-specific datasets to hobbyists. All right, let's do it. All right, everyone, I am on the line with Jennifer Hobbs. Jennifer is a senior data scientist with Stats. Jennifer, welcome to This Week in Machine Learning and AI.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. So you got your PhD in physics and astronomy. How did you make your way to data science? And just as interestingly, how did you make your way into sports data science?
Sure. So my background is, you know, starting from undergraduate, I was at Northwestern. I was in the integrated science program and also studied math and physics. I actually originally started out in neutrino physics and did research at Fermilab for several years, starting when I was an undergraduate and then continuing into my PhD. And about maybe during my first or second year of my PhD, I realized that that's not quite where my passion was. And, you know, looked at a couple of different labs, and I'd always had an interest in neuroscience and kind of how the brain worked. And so I wound up working with a professor who was in a biomedical engineering and mechanical engineering lab, looking at how the brain encodes touch. And so in particular, studying the rat whisker system. So I joined that lab and started doing some behavioral as well as computational neuroscience work. And really through that is how I kind of became exposed to machine learning. I really hadn't had any exposure or really knowledge of the field prior to that, but just particularly through a neural coding project that I worked on, really started to learn about all of the, work that had been done in you know, pattern recognition and machine learning for years, and really found that to be my passion and got involved in that. And then after graduating, I was actually at a insurance company doing predictive analytics for a year. And then this position at Stats opened up where they were, you know, creating a new AI data science team to, you know, leverage this wealth of data that Stats has and to, produce new insights and, you know, leverage machine learning and AI to really kind of revolutionize how we understand and ingest and even take sports data.
Interesting. So that first exposure to machine learning from a neuroscience perspective, was that you mentioned that was a project that you worked on as opposed to a class. Can you elaborate on it?
Sure. So one of the great things about my graduate school lab was that we were from all sorts of different departments. So I was in physics. We had applied math people, neuroscience students, BME students, MECI students, all in the same lab, which made it, you know, a great, really kind of fertile cross collaboration. And one of the students who was BME, more on the BME neuroscience side, he had been taking all of this neural recordings from primary sensory neurons and saying, like, well, how do we understand what the brain is actually encoding? What is the actual original input and the appropriate representation that goes into the neurons that that the rat could be using to make these discrimination tasks much higher up, kind of later in the processing stage? And so I was asked to kind of be involved in the project and kind of help do that because I had the more, you know, mathematical background. And so really it was just kind of like, here's the problem we're trying to solve. We have whiskers that are being tracked. From there, it goes into a mechanical model. We can get forces and moments, and we want to predict. And then we have neural recordings. We have an electrical signal. From that, we can extract spikes. And we basically want to go from, you know, mechanics to spikes and see what the neurons are encoding. And in trying to solve it, that's really where I got exposed. And so, you know, we were using things like general linearized models. But in the process of learning that, then I was just exposed to the whole, you know, breadth and wealth of techniques that were out there.
Yeah, I never cease to be fascinated by this kind of two-way relationship between neuroscience and machine learning, where learning and being inspired by neuroscience to innovate on the machine learning side, but neuroscience is also benefiting heavily from that innovation in the way they understand neurons. Super interesting work. What does stats do? You kind of mentioned sports and sports data, but what's the idea behind the company?
Yeah, so stats is, you know, been around for about 35 years, and we have this huge amount of data that we collect across all types of sports, you know, common sports that you think of, you know, football, basketball, baseball, but also some that you've probably never have and you'll never experience because they're more remote. And so we have all of these kind of records and data that exist there. But in addition to that, you know, for certain sports, we have kind of a next level of data that's our event data. So if you were to look at a sport like soccer, we know where, you know, we know information about passes and shots and things like that we can use to further understand the game, to really start telling it, you know, a better story of what actually occurs and who's contributing and how. And then kind of as the layer on top of that, again, in sports like soccer and basketball, we have player and ball tracking information. So really at every point during a game, we know where all the players are on the field and we know where the ball is. And then that really allows us to tell, you know, an even richer story and understand the game and really kind of, you know, draw further insights and do, you know, more complex analysis to really recreate the game from this data.
And who is the target or end consumer of the analysis that you're doing? Is it the teams or consumers, like via media products?
Right. So it spans everybody. A lot of it is media facing. So if you can imagine you're watching a game, and a lot of times an announcer will add some kind of statistics that have to add color to it. You know, very likely that data is coming from us. And, you know, then even as a consumer, if you're, you know, going onto a site or you're asking, you know, for a sports statistic, chances are we're providing that data as well. But also the teams, there's a, you know, team performance space where teams want to know, again, all of the stats about their players. And, you know, now that as we're, you know, adding more advanced analytics on top of that through machine learning, you know, how can we actually deliver them insights directly as opposed to just maybe raw data points?
Interesting. I must be the only one that thought that sports announcers just had these amazing statistical memories for their teams that they follow.
Right, right. No, it's impressive the amount of manpower from, you know, just at all levels, whether it's, you know, the kind of the engineering side that creates the database, that stores it, that allows that data to be accessed quickly, to the more, you know, media facing people who are, you know, in the truck, knowing how to access that data and kind of find the right, you know, ask the right question to surface the right insight so that you can get that kind of interesting fact during the broadcast.
Along those lines, can you talk a little bit about your data pipeline, the way you kind of conceive of and mapping out all of the data that's coming in and the flows and how you process it?
Sure. So a lot of that is very, very sport and also like data specific. So how we collect what I'd call a traditional box score data is different from, you know, the tracking data. So our group focuses primarily on how we make value out of the tracking data. So for a sport like basketball, for instance, you know, we have, you know, cameras in venue that would, you know, collect the, you know, track the players, And then, you know, produce these, you know, process it using, you know, computer vision techniques, and then extract the positions, and then, you know, intake that for later analysis. And then our group is, you know, really saying, all right, now, you could imagine that the way you ingest and store data from just kind of a storage perspective is different than how you maybe want to format it to make discoveries and make insights and kind of surface them quickly. So a lot of the work that our group has done has been to really kind of look at a lot of the advances in technologies in the big data space and you know, some of the cloud computing and NoSQL databases out there to, you know, how can we shape the data in a way that answers questions of interest and allows us to do the analysis that we want. You know, so then we can, you know, take this raw data and start, start enriching it, start adding information on top of it. And again, you can imagine that there's so much data that for a single game, you know, depending on the sport, 10, 20, you know, points per player per second across an entire game, there's a huge amount of data there. So really leveraging a lot of those, the big data stack that exists out there to process and analyze and literally just kind of move it around so that it can be surfaced quickly.
Interesting. So does your group, or even do you personally identify more with the data engineering and kind of infrastructure side of things, or more the statistical analysis and the data product side of things?
So we really get to interact with it from throughout the entire life cycle, because and I think that's really important, because the representation and the right, the way you encode and format and understand and represent your data is really critical for any analysis to occur downstream. So, you know, we work with engineering to actually, like, you know, to build the products, to put it into production, but, you know, we're keenly involved in saying, like, what is that right representation? What is the right storage? How do we how do we format and store this data and describe this data in a way that really captures all the information and isn't lossy? Because we don't want to do anything to the data that could possibly, lose information. And so we're certainly involved in kind of that early process. And then we, you know, work with engineering to build out the pipelines so that we can do the analysis. We build the models, and then we get those models into production. And then we also interact closely with our design team as far as, all right, you can imagine, you know, I have a certain insight, a certain data point that I want to surface to the end user. But whether that end user is a team or a consumer or a media client, the same piece of information could be ingested in different ways. So what's the right way of presenting that to, you know, answer the questions that they're looking for?
Do any particular examples come to mind of how the representation, you know, particularly as deep as, you know, the way the data was stored had an impact on the insights that you were ultimately able to derive, or the models that you were ultimately able to create, and kind of that back and forth between representation and product?
Sure. So, you could imagine that, you know, again, for our tracking data, we have all of the positions of the players, and there is so much information there that, you know, how it's stored and how it is accessed is very, very important for processing time, as well as our ability to do analysis. So, one of the things that you know, our group does is that we work directly on the trajectory. So given the players, you know, we can leverage both the individual player motions as well as the group structure that's involved in sports to start, you know, to build our analysis, to do our predictions. So one of the challenging things with sport, you can imagine, is that they're not just, you know, think of basketball. They're not just five independent agents per team, right? They're interacting with people, with their teammates. They're also interacting with the other their team. To try and understand an individual player's movement kind of in isolation is really losing that interactiveness that exists. In contrast to, say, something like pedestrian detection, where you have, a variable number of people out there and they're just kind of trying to avoid each other and things like that, right? There's a much more complexity in that kind of group behavior that exists in sports. And so we're really able to exploit that and work on the trajectories together and understand that all of the players are really involved in interacting, and from there build our models, which really allows us to, again, like to work on that really true raw representation of the data.
And so to make sure I understand that, is there or at some point in designing this pipeline, this process, was there a trade-off between whether you stored player information individually or in the context of a team, and you chose to do it in the context of a team? Is that what you're getting at here?
So from the data model, not as much. You know, you can imagine having each player has a location. But then kind of once we have that stored, you know, how we leverage it is really kind of where the key is, or maybe I'm not quite following your question. Sorry.
Oh, no, I was going back to your comment about how you found it important to tie kind of the underlying data engineering to the kind of the work to be done, and how you often find that, you know, the problems you're trying to solve influences the way you need to store and represent the data at a low level. And I was kind of digging for examples of, you know, where that low level representation, you know, made a big impact, or you weren't able to accomplish something until you tweaked that low level representation.
Sure. So, right, really having, you know, information about all the players at every point in time is really key. And so kind of from a data perspective, that's really where we operate. And then, you know, at the more of the modeling stage, if you look at a lot of the work that our group has done, has been around like leveraging the formational alignment of players so that we can really understand, again, operating directly off of the trajectories as opposed to, you know, having to operate.
It sounds like maybe what I'm hearing then is you may have this data that is, you know, it may come in as images, and you have to figure out how to store that. And then you may extract from that XY positional information. But you know, also want to eventually get to player trajectories. And as opposed to having to figure that out each time, you need to be able to store that. And so there's this constant trying to figure out how to store these things that you're ultimately going to need to go further with your end products. Is that where you're going?
Sure. That's certainly, you know, one aspect of it is, you know, extracting as much information as we can out of the image and then, you know, going through the whole tracking life cycle, if you will, you know, from detections to tracks to really understand where all of the players are. There's kind of a second step to that, which is the group has done a lot of work on search in sports. So you can imagine that, you know, if you're watching a game and you see a play and you say, well, that's really interesting. I want to know if that's when that play has been run before. I want to find similar plays. Like how do you do that with, you know, multiple agents, and how do you search for that? And you can imagine, say, well, if I have, you know, all of my data coming in is based on player ID. I know that this human was standing in this position. But if I limit myself to only looking based on identity, it really kind of limits my ability to find those similar plays. So a lot of the work that the group has done is to recognize, again, that group structure and to find the right way to represent them so that we can find plays based on where a player is in their positional formation, as opposed to being like kind of stuck to the identity. So certainly there's kind of two phases there. There's the, I want to be able to represent the data in my data model so that I have all of it available to me. And then if I want to be able to query it, I don't want to be necessarily bound to something as hard as identity. I want to know where the player is in their group position.
Interesting. So this search function that you're describing, it's not relying at all, it sounds like, on tagged, this is a X play, like a named play or something like that. It's based on kind of the relative positions of the players.
Correct. Right. We want to learn the playbook directly from the data. So you could imagine a coach, you know, having to go through and say, all right, like, here's, here's play alpha, here's play beta, whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously very, you know, onerous and time consuming on the coach. But again, you see the structure that exists in sport. You see certain actions, certain plays that get run repeatedly. And if we can recognize those as kind of entities, you know, ourselves when we're watching a game, you know, the computer should be able to learn how to do that by leveraging machine learning. So what we're able to do is to find those similar plays just directly from the ball and player trajectories. So that you could imagine, like, here's a similar play, here's a play, can I find all of the plays just like that?
Huh. Can you walk us through the kind of the types of models that you use to do this? Like the input data sounds like positions and trajectories. Like, how do you, how does it work, I guess, you know, to the extent that you can share it?
Sure. So again, like, members of the group have done a lot of work on this for a while, and it's a little bit, you know, the way we've actually implemented it for different sports has some slight subtleties. But the general idea is that we're able to using the trajectories of all of the players, find where they kind of fit into a formation. So we find some kind of ordering that preserves the structure. And then from there.
And so, if I can push pause on that, what does that mean? Like, how are you representing that? Is this like a spatial type of model? Like, position one is, you know, X, you know, some distance and angle from another, or is it some other kind of thing?
Right. So, it's, in some ways more general than that. So you could imagine for a sport like soccer that you could say, well, here's the center back. And again, you could imagine somebody going through and actually tagging all of the players. But players swap positions. They move around. And so somebody who's kind of nominally in one position in a given play, they might have, you know, switched with their partner just to get, you know, back into defensive position to have all of the spots filled. Mm-hmm. And so what we're able to do is say, well, I can actually learn directly from the data, the formation that this team plays. And so even though this person is maybe nominally a left back, in this particular play, he had a switch, you know, places with somebody else, and he's actually playing on the right side right now. And so from their positions, we're actually able to, you know, match them back to a known formation, and then use their positions at that time, not just some kind of hard coded tag. And that really allows us to understand their positioning based on where they are in this, again, in this kind of group formational structure, as opposed to a label that's fixed throughout the course of the game.
Okay, so the first step is kind of representing the general formation of the team, so the players relative to one another. And then what's next?
So once we understand where the players are in relationship to their, you know, their formational template, like, that allows us to then say, all right, you know, given that I know they're here, I can maintain a certain ordering. And, you know, for machine learning and AI to work, you know, the computer needs to have some kind of, you know, fixed expectation of how, of the incoming order of the features that you're going to pass to it. So you can imagine that, you know, by knowing where the players are and where they fall in the structure, this allows us to have that fixed representation of where they are. And then from there, we can do, you know, any sort of analysis on top of it. If it's, you know, in this case for search, it allows us to start, you know, creating a consistent metric so that we're comparing, you know, the person in the left back position always to, you know, other left backs, even if at the start of the game that he might have been listed as a different positional player.
And you have this formation information. Do you look at transitions of that formation from, you know, A to B to C relative to the movement of the ball or things like that over time? Like, I guess, you know, the picture that I have in my head when you talk about plays is like your classic, like, clipboard, you know, player here, and then transitions or trajectories or something like that. And I'm trying to map all that to the machine learning context and what you're doing.
Sure. So you could imagine as kind of a base level, you could just say, well, I think there's some kind of general formation out there, you know, maybe that a team has. And you can certainly learn that. And then you can say, well, you know, particularly in soccer, as the, you know, as the ball moves, as a team transitions from defense to offense, you really kind of see that formation change. You might see them become more aggressive offensively as they get the ball near their attacking goal. And you can see the defenders kind of step up. And so that formation changes. So by using various hierarchical methods, we can actually learn, you know, a set or a relationship of these different formations, and then look to see, well, okay, how does it change? You know, does that formation change when I'm on an offense versus defense, when I have the ball closer to my goal? What happens if I'm winning or losing? Do I start to kind of change that, change that formation to protect my lead as opposed to being more aggressive and trying to score? And so like we observe those changes, but because we're able to detect that automatically from the data, you know, it's not something that we have to go through and kind of, again, painstakingly label. It's something that we can detect automatically.
Right. You mentioned hierarchical methods. Can you elaborate on that?
So, sure. So one of our team members had done work particularly in basketball on this, just as we're learning these kind of different templates for these different states. He has an approach to do multi-agent hierarchical clustering. So again, we have trajectories for all of the players, and we can say, all right, like how do we find kind of, again, that base formation? And then from there, saying, all right, like this is a certain state. And then we kind of step into that and say, all right, like what's the right way to essentially, you know, order the players within that state. And then from there, can I split that up? Do substates exist? You know, are there additional, you know, clusters within there, and kind of keep breaking down and doing this approach until we can, you know, find these very specific, play states that we can identify.
I came across a paper that you co-authored about myth-busting set pieces in soccer. Mm-hmm. Can you share what that one is about?
So this is a paper that that we presented at Sloan this past year. And set pieces are, you know, something that teams are really interested in because, you know, they can, you know, produce a lot of scoring opportunities. But there's also some myths about, well, when I, you know, when I take a set piece, if I'm too aggressive, like, is it going to lead, you know, to a chance by the other team? And so really the idea here was to just kind of go through some of the commonly held beliefs around set pieces and really just, you know, look at what the data says. Instead of going, you know, by your gut, can we actually go through and kind of tick these off and say, you know, what does the data actually support? And I think that's one of the, you know, really exciting things about what we do in this group is that, you know, a lot of people, you know, whether it's a coach, whether it's a fan, they've, you know, seen a lot of sport. They have intuition for it. They have, you know, these kind of gut instincts as to what's there. But really, with the availability of tracking data, we can actually get to what the data says and actually answer these types of questions that really just aren't available otherwise.
And for those that don't know, set pieces are like corner kicks and free kicks in
correct.
Soccer.
Yes. Yeah.
And another question I had was in that paper, there were, you had some like really interesting heat maps of the player positions relative to these set pieces. Is that produced from the, like, the visual positioning data that you get?
Correct. So, you know, at a certain level, we can just look to, you know, look at the ball and see where teams attempt to deliver a kick in these scenarios. But then we can kind of go a step further and say, all right, let's use the tracking data to maybe understand how teams defend corners, for instance. And so in that case, again, we have the we have all the player tracking data, and using a convolutional neural net, we can use the data and determine whether a team is in a zonal defense or a man-to-man defense or something in more of a hybrid. And then once we're able to detect that, then we can say, all right, like, does that lead to do any of these lead to more goals than the other?
So this sounds like it maybe ties to some of the previous work that we discussed, where you've figured out through maybe these hierarchical approaches that you've used, or the templates, like, you know, these types of defenses, and then you've maybe have those labeled somewhere as like labeled pictures, you know, this is this defense, this is another. And then you use that as the input to a CNN classifier to figure out for a given image. Is that what you're doing?
Right. So in the case of set pieces, it's a little bit different than open play. Like, you imagine in open play, again, there's this really strong formational signature that exists. For something like a corner, the way players set up is more chaotic. It kind of lacks that you know, strong, again, formation that you would imagine. And so here we actually, in this work, just operated like directly on like the image representation of the players. So you could imagine, you know, knowing where each player is, thinking of it, you know, as having a point in an image being occupied. And then from there saying, all right, if I know how they're moving, I can detect certain features, you know, using the CNN, and then from some labels. So so Paul, who was the first author on the paper, he has a, you know, tremendous background in soccer. And so he was able to, you know, to go through and like look at the video, look at the trajectories and say, all right, this is an example of a hybrid defense as opposed to a man defense, as opposed to a zone defense. And then once we have those, you know, build the classifier to detect those automatically going forward.
You took like a myth busting type of approach in the paper, obviously, given the title, and you identified 10 specific myths that folks held about these types of situations, like a team is more likely to score from a free kick cross compared to a corner. And then you like, you busted that myth and showed, no, there's only a 2% chance of scoring from the corner as opposed to a 1% chance of scoring from the free kick. And there were a bunch of other of these types of myths. Was there any that was most kind of surprising or interesting to the team?
I think the work that just, you know, identifying the defenses that the teams were playing was really interesting. Just kind of seeing the relative frequencies that each played in was interesting. I think the one that I think most surprised most people on the team was about defending the post. So I think a lot of people believe that, you know, you should put a man on at least one of the posts, near and or far. But what this work showed was that having players on both posts actually, you know, conceded the most number of goals, while having a player on the back post conceded the fewest. And you know, in some ways you say, well, I don't know. I know, you know, by putting a player on the post, you're certainly kind of cutting down on the angle, but you're in some ways giving the offense more freedom to move around. So I think that's one instance where people have really strong feelings either way, you know, one way or the other. So I think that was probably the most surprising to members of the team.
Can you talk a little bit about the way you processed your data for this particular task?
Right. So for all of this, you know, we leveraged both the event data that we have, again, that has things like shots, passes, crosses, corners, the type of pass, where it occurred from, who took it, as well as the tracking data. And so, you know, like in much of the work that we do, it's really a matter of bringing it all together. And here it was a combination of both, you know, in some cases constructing features, you know, by hand that we could analyze, as well as, you know, in the case of like detecting the defense, you know, using deep learning approaches to, in some ways, you know, construct the features for us. So, you know, it was a really nice paper because it really brought together in some ways like all facets of both the data and the analysis side, the events and the tracking, as well as kind of the handcrafted features, as well as the deep learned features.
And in addition to the specific the myths that you busted, you also looked at the predictive power of the model, like the model's ability to predict whether a given team, you know, what formation a team is likely to take given one of these set points or set pieces, rather. How successful was that part of the project?
Are you talking about the defense or just like the general setup part?
Well, elaborate on both of those. I thought I saw in there an element of predicting what a given team was likely to do, I guess, defensively.
Okay, sure. Right. So, you know, again, this used both the event as well as the tracking data. But, you know, we can go through and look at, you know, all of the set pieces that a team has taken over the course of the season and say, all right, you know, offensively, do they take, you know, in swinging and out or versus out swinging corners, you know, short corners, you know, do they attempt to do flick ons? And how often, you know, do they, you know, try to use this style, as well as how successful are they at executing on that style? And then defensively, again, you know, having been able to detect the type of setups that they use, you know, how likely are they to set up in a certain situation? And then, you know, when they set up that way, how likely is that to lead to a goal? And so at a glance, we can kind of look at teams and their frequency and their success in each of these styles and say, you know, how do they likely play, or when they're playing well, how do they likely set up? And then from there, we can say, okay, you know, given two teams, I can imagine, you know, predicting, you know, given the offensive style of one and the defensive style of the other, how might they match up?
It sounds like the predictions that you were doing about, you know, what a team is likely to do in any given situation were not matchup based. I don't know if this question makes any sense.
Sure. So I think what you're getting at is, so in this particular paper, we didn't do predictions off of the matchup. That's kind of the next step. You know, what we are looking up at here is kind of how strong is the stylistic signature of a team. You know, certain teams you could imagine that they might want to take, you know, the same corner the same way every single time, regardless of who they're playing or how the defense sets up. Maybe they're very, very predictable just historically. Mm-hmm. But another team could be, I don't really care how I take it. I just want to do whatever is the most effective. So I'm going to look at the defense, and whatever they present, you know, to me, I'm going to take whatever I feel is the best approach in that moment. And so here it was more of a, how predictable is a team historically? But again, once you've kind of created this, you know, style analysis of the team, the next step is to say, all right, you know, given two teams, how do I expect them to interact?
Awesome. Awesome. Well, what are some other interesting projects on your roadmap or to-do list? How do you see kind of the application of ML and deep learning and AI evolving as applied to sports?
You know, so the availability of tracking data really kind of, you know, leaves us with endless possibilities. There's, you know, so much that we can do there to understand, again, the plays that teams run, to identify plays, and then to predict future plays, to do things like, to predict where the players will be. So another paper, you know, that our group was involved with through a collaboration with Disney, you know, the past couple of years was, through a collaboration with Disney Research, the past 2 years, there's been some work at Sloan on ghosting. So originally it was done in soccer, and this past year for basketball, where, you know, given the offensive players, like, could you, you know, predict, you know, where the defensive players are? And so there's, you know, a lot of interesting things there. We have this huge wealth of data, and with, you know, all the advances in machine learning, in particular in deep learning, we can start to do really fine grained analysis and simulation, predicting where the players are, where they'll go, what type of plays could be run. There's really just a huge amount of different avenues that you can go there. And, you know, it's really all, you know, largely driven by the data, and having access to the data is really what enables us to ask these, you know, very specific questions. What if, you know, given a play and I have a shot, you know, what if I move players around? What if a different player took the shot? There's a lot of opportunities to do personalized modeling, which we've done. So as I was explaining, again, like given a certain play, you know, what happens if there's a different defender, a different shooter? What happens if the angle or the distances are just slightly different? How does that impact the outcome? And then building up from single plays to more complex, kind of longer scale activities.
You mentioned in there how this all kind of revolves around having access to the data. I'm curious, what's your sense for how accessible sports applications of ML are for hobbyists? Like, are there freely available or open source data sets that you're familiar with that folks could use to play around with? Certainly, you know, clearly sports is a hobby for a lot of people, and data science is a, you know, a hobby or interest for a lot of people. If folks wanted to combine those two and get started, are there ways to do interesting things, or, you know, are all the data sources kind of proprietarily collected?
You know, I think in the past, certainly from my experience, you know, before I was here, you know, a lot of times people looking for sports data were kind of, limited to trying to scrape things off of websites and that to build their models. We actually, through some of the papers that our group has published, have three data sets out there that people can request for research purposes. One of them is in soccer. One of them is in basketball. Those are both trajectory based. Related to the trajectory analysis that we've done. So we have actually through our website have three data sets that people can request to do academic research work, you know, hobbyist type analysis. Two of them are trajectory based, one of them for soccer, one of them for basketball. They're probably more complex, you know, it's just literally like XY position of the players. And so you have to use some sophisticated techniques there to really kind of parse it and understand it, because it's, you know, again, pretty complex data. But one of the other papers that we had at Sloan this past year was doing win probability analysis. And so there is another data set that we have where you can, look at that data to recreate some of those results. And probably I'd say, like, for the general public, that's probably the most accessible one, that if players wanted to, that if people wanted to get their hands dirty with, it's a really unique set of data that they can use to answer a bunch of questions.
Well, Jennifer, thanks so much for taking the time to share what you're working on. It sounds like really fun stuff.
Yep. Yeah, it's great. You know, we have really a huge amount of data out there that we can do, really interesting things with, across a variety of sports. And, it's ever evolving. And with a lot of the advances over the past, several years, really kind of the sky's the limit as far as what we can explore and what kind of new data points we can reveal and interesting questions that we can ask and answer.
Fantastic. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right, everyone, that's our show for today. For more information on Jennifer or any of the topics covered in this episode, head on over to twimlai.com/talk/157. To follow along with the AI in Sports series, visit twimlai.com/AI in Sports. If you're a fan of the podcast, we'd like to encourage you to head to iTunes and leave us your best rating and review. They are super helpful as we push to grow this show and the community. As always, thanks so much for listening, and catch you next time.